The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. At Bright Vibe, we believe everyone deserves to be happy. But in today's world, everywhere you turn, there is division and negativity. At Bright Vibe, we have created a global movement to bring 8 million people together who are inspired to live bright, live bold, and share bright vibes. Alone, it can be hard to change, but together we can change the world. Welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. All right, Bruce Feiler, welcome to the Bright Vibe Podcast. I am so excited to have you on today.
I want to say, in the spirit of bright, that my mother used to say, you look very bright-eyed and bushy-tailed today. Even though you've had your own, you know, it's probably not a life quake, but you've had your own medical journey in recent days. So good for you for bouncing back so quickly.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. I was sharing pre-show. I had my appendix out, I guess, 10 days ago, something like this. And it was actually one of the highlight experiences I've had in a while. It was a very interesting to watch me respond, to watch the mind, but watch the body respond. And where I went was not where I thought I would go. I'm super thankful that it happened. I'll put it that way. I'm just super thankful and blessed. It was the most extreme pain I've ever felt. You know, spent hours on the bathroom floor, ambulances, all kinds of meds. And then finally they cut me open they did the laparoscopic and took it out. But it was a most interesting experience. I was just actually felt very blessed and thankful to have the experience once it was all over, just because I got to see how I would have responded maybe years ago and how I respond now. And this is kind of dovetails into a lot of what you write about, which life is in the transitions, right? These transitionary times where we find out kind of more about ourselves. So you're a profound author. You've got, you know, 7 New York Times bestsellers, which is amazing to me because I know that's no easy feat in and of itself. I know several authors and have interviewed several authors, and I've never interviewed any author who's had 7 New York Times bestsellers. You know, Life is in the Transitions, The Secret of Happy Families, Council of Dads. You've got a lot of TED Talks. I also, you know, through my research, really thought this was interesting. Walking the Bible, which is I'm very curious about as well. So you've got lots of fun fodder for today's conversation. You've got a new book out.
The Search, Finding Meaningful Work in a Post-Career World.
And you read a newsletter, The Nonlinear Life. So, and you were a cancer survivor, correct?
Let's meet the moment that we're in. Let's talk about what it means on day one to be lying in pain in a fetal position in any place, and 10 days later to say it's one of the most profound and meaningful experiences of my life. Because that, in fact, is the space or a space that I occupy right now. And so let me, I'll set the stage by trying to tie all of these things together. Until we get to the point of you on the floor and then you with you the color color in your cheeks and the smile on your face and the twinkle in your eye. So I grew up in Savannah, Georgia. Mm-hmm. I left there and went to Yale in the 80s and went from there to Japan and started writing letters home. I'm older than you are, but on crinkly airmail paper. Like, you're not going to believe what happened to me today. And when I got back to Georgia 6 months later, everyone said, I loved your letters. And I was like, great. Have we met? And it turned out that my grandmother had Xeroxed them and passed them around, and they went viral in a sort of old-fashioned sense of the word. And I thought, well, if this is that interesting to me and all these people, like, I should write a book about this. And it doesn't happen this way, but I sold my first book 35 years ago, and I've never held a job since. So,
wow. That's amazing.
And in the context of the conversation we're about to have, I think of my life as sort of that classic linear upward trajectory, right? I wrote a series of books in my 20s. I wrote a book about Japan. I wrote a book about Oxford and Cambridge. I spent a year as a circus clown. I then, as you said, went back and forth to the Middle East, writing books and making television about religion and spirituality and how these are changing and how we find meaning in our lives, perhaps different from how we grew up and as our needs change over time. And so this is that classic linear life. Like I figured out what I wanted to do early. I did it for no money. I had some success. I got married. I had children. Like I was on top of the world, right? In entrepreneurial terms, I was on the up at the handle of the hockey stick, right?
Right. Yep.
And then my life blew up in my 40s. First, as you said, I got cancer at 43. As a parent of three-year-old identical twin daughters, I had a 9-inch osteosarcoma in my left femur. So suddenly I was the walking guy who couldn't walk again. Then I had some financial troubles in the last recession. And then my dad, who had Parkinson's, got very depressed and tried to take his own life six times in 12 weeks.
Oh, wow.
So this was a crisis, you know, by almost any metric. And here I am a storyteller, right? You know, some of those bestsellers had preceded this date, right? And particularly, and I spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, the greatest stories ever told and how they related to our lives today, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And suddenly I couldn't tell my own life story. And what happened was, Matt, that when I started telling it tentatively to people, everyone had a story about how their life got upended in some way. And the language that they used was that I was somehow like off schedule or off track or off kilter. Like the life I expected to be living is not the life that I am living. And I called my wife, it was actually after a college reunion, and I said, no one knows how to tell their life story anymore, and let me do something to help. And so what I've done, it's now been almost 8 years since I started this project, is I have spent this time crisscrossing the country, collecting what has become almost 500 life stories of Americans of all ages, all walks of life. I'm talking about people who lost homes, who lost limbs, who changed careers, who changed religions, who got sober, got out of bad marriages. And I do these long, intensive kind of life story interviews with them. And then I have this team of people and we code them looking for patterns. And sort of the core question is like, how do we make meaning? How do we readjust our lives? Like, how do we add a new chapter to our life story when it's suddenly kind of thrown off track? And that's the essence of what I'm doing. I've now done two books in this space. The first is called Life is in the Transitions, which is how we navigate these events that I call life quakes when our lives are upended. And then The Search is about what happens when we have work quakes, right? When something happens in our work lives that we want to make a change, we want more meaning. Like, how do we navigate that? Like, we've been sort of brainwashed over, you know, a century that we have to have a career and has to be linear and has to grow and the resume has to look a certain way. But that doesn't reflect, in fact, our lives where we have lots of twists and turns. And so my life in a lot of ways is, if you're lying in a fetal position on the floor of your bathroom, under your bed, you know, in a war zone, in a hospital room, whatever it is, how do you get from there to exactly what I'm seeing before me on this video that people are not able to see as you and I talk? A smile on your face saying, I've learned from it and I'm ready now to lean into my life.
Yeah, exactly. For me, there was one, I thought I had food poisoning. So there was this concept of, oh, I have food poisoning, just tough it out, I'll get over it. In that, between basically, I don't know, about 9 p.m. and 2 a.m. when I called the ambulance, there was this conversation that was happening with God where it was the culmination of the low point, which would have happened 3 or 4 years ago when I was thinking of taking my own life because of everything we've just talked about, financial upheaval. I mean, COVID just was a wrecking ball on my life. And I got to the point where it was totally meaningless, nothing but pain, nothing but suffering. It was just horrible, horrible, horrible. You know, thank God for my kids and my wife that kept me grounded enough to stay here. But this was like the other, not the completion of that, but the test of the faith that was built through that recovery process of being at this low point where I'm, you know, literally, you know, thinking about carrying a bullet in my pocket to, okay, this is the most excruciating pain I've ever experienced in my life. I mean, literally I'm bent over. I can't hardly breathe. I've got nothing left in my system on the floor. And am I going to turn towards God or am I going to turn away from God? And so it became a very spiritual experience for me of not turning away from. And there was literally the thought of, as I'm wrenching out my guts, and the thought became, if this is what needs to happen to me physically to heal me, to set me free from the molds or the paradigm or the the constructs that I have, then do whatever you have to do to me to get me healed. Just heal me. I don't care what physically has to happen to me. Just heal me, Lord, right? I don't think I've even shared that with my wife. And that was just the what was coming through me. And that was the only thing I could focus on because I was in so much pain. I mean, it was a 10 out of 10.
What was your role before I comment on this? And thank you for sharing. I appreciate the vulnerability and I'm honored by it. So in this construct that you've just shared, how much of this is God's responsibility and how much of it's your responsibility?
Responsibility as far as?
The healing process. Where does the agency lie?
I guess, and I don't know that I have a suit. I have not thought of it that way. I guess for me, the healing, I would say the healing process, which is over the last 3 or 4 years, is 100% God's grace and or 99.99%. And the 0.01% is me just taking the next step forward. So I would say that the healing is all God's grace. And I have just been the recipient of that grace, even when it didn't feel good. And this experience, physically, it doesn't feel good, but there was something in me that knew that this was grace at work. I will also say that because I thought it was food poisoning, I thought it was something I could tough through to the point of literally feeling like I was going to pass out to the point of saying, because I hate going to, I mean, when I woke my wife up and said, hey, it was 2 a.m. I said, hey, I need to go to the hospital. She knew that something was seriously wrong because there's no way I would normally do that.
Yeah.
So for me, that final act that night was an act of surrender. Right. Because I went from thinking I'm going to figure this out, I'm going to be okay, to I'm not okay. And now it's time to let life, God, people to take care of me because I can't. I'm to the point where I have to surrender.
So there's about 3 conversations that we could now have.
This was supposed to be about you, Bruce. This wasn't supposed to be the Matt Lilly story.
You're going to learn a little bit about me in the next few minutes based on how I respond to this. Let me tell you the ways I don't want to go with this story. But I could in a different life or a future conversation, right? One is the myth of toughing it through, right? Which is a sort of a masculine myth that we are engendered from a very young age, that we have to be the fix-it and the problem solvers, and that we have to do that. If you're interested in that, go read Council of Dads, which is my story of when I was sick, reaching out to 6 friends of mine and asking them to be in a council of dads to be present for my daughters in the event that I died. This went on to be a TED Talk. It went on to be a primetime series on NBC. I leave a long Google trail of talking about modern masculinity. And that's a conversation that we could have that leave off stage. Okay.
Fair enough.
Then there's a sort of the part of me that wrote 5 books about the Bible that could talk about grace and agency and where do we draw the line between what we want, you know, God or a divinity or spirituality or the universe or whatever language you like to do for you, what we should do ourselves. That's another interesting conversation. But let's focus on a different aspect of it, which is the meaning making through the pain. Okay.
Yep.
So let me go back to the big thing that I've learned in the work I've been doing now with what I call the Life Story Project, right? So the number one thing I learned is that the linear life is dead, right? The idea that we're going to follow ideas, a life pattern where the only changes in our lives are going to happen, the birthdays that end in 0. The idea of the midlife crisis when it was invented in the 1970s was everyone does the same thing in their 20s. Everyone does the same thing in their 30s, and then everybody has a quote-unquote midlife crisis between 39 and 44 and a half. That's literally what the research said. this is bunk. And by the way, it's a historical anomaly. Like in the ancient world, they thought life was a cycle because agriculture was a cycle. It was actually the Hebrew Bible that introduces the idea of linear time, right? The idea of a family from Adam and Eve, right, down through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. And David, and if you're a Christian, then through Jesus in the New Testament, right? So this is a linear construct so that by the Middle Ages, they think life is a staircase up to middle age and then down. That's not how we grew up. We grew up with that life was a descent to middle age and then a staircase up. But even this idea is wrong. Okay, so the linear life is dead. It's been replaced by what I call the nonlinear life, which involves many more twists and turns, unexpected events, setbacks, leaps forward, whatever you want to call them. Okay. And my data show that we go through 36 what I call disruptors in the course of a life. It could be as small as a fender bender or twisting your ankle or as big as having your house burned down or losing a loved one. And most of these we get through relatively easily, as you've just seen with your appendicitis. But one in 10 of them is a big enough event that it becomes what I call a lifequake. And we have 3 to 5 of these events in our lives. And the signature piece of data, and at least the part of this that has to do with life, we can get to the work part later, is that their average length is 5 years.
Wow. But
there's this long process.
Wow. That's surprising.
Yes, exactly. It's fascinating. Okay. Mm-hmm. So why? Because the way to think about it is the lifequake puts you on your heels.
Yep.
I'm sick. Woe is me. Mm-hmm. I want to take my life. Yep. I'm going bankrupt. Okay. I've had a divorce. I've been drinking too much and I've left wreckage in my life, whatever it might be. So we feel passive, reactive, overwhelmed. Okay. And people tend to do one of two things. Okay. They either make a 212 item to-do list and say, I'm going to get through in the weekend. I'm going to be the best ever. And I'm going to get up and I'm going to be, everyone's going to know that I was the greatest person at responding to this event in my life. Okay.
Right.
And the other half of people lie in a fetal position, if perhaps on the bathroom floor, under their covers with a cat and say, woe is me. No one's ever been through this. And my life is worse than everybody else.
Right.
Neither of these is true. In fact, when you look at enough of these events, there are certain patterns that become clear. And so this leads to the sort of core frame is that the lifequake is the event.
Right.
It's the appendicitis. It's the depression. It's the losing the job. It's the pandemic. And the lifequake puts you on your heels. And the life transition is what puts you on your toes. It's the human reaction. It's the human exercise. And even if it's only 0.01% or whatever you said in this metric, God can help you realize that the lifequake needs a human response, but the transition is fundamentally a personal event. And that's the third of the big lessons, which is that transitions are a skill that we can and we must master. And that's where the heart of my work is. And so when you look at enough of these events, they have certain phases, okay? So the first phase of a life transition is what I call the long goodbye, where you have to accept the emotions that you're in this event and you use rituals and things to mark it and to say to yourself, I need help. I'm going through a difficult time. I'm out of control. I'm depressed, right? I'm, you know, suicidal or whatever it might be. That's the long goodbye. Then you enter this phase, which I call the messy middle, right? Where you shed certain habits, experiment with new ones, reach out to support, and you begin to craft this new self, which is an ugly process. It's 2 steps forward, 4 steps back, 6 forward, stable for 2 years when you think you're done, and then realizing there's still more leaps forward. Right. And then the last phase is the new beginning, where you sort of update your life story, you add a new chapter to it, and you then unveil your new self. And so here's the thing. The kind of the 212 item to-do listers, they kind of thrive in the messy middle. Okay, I'm in a situation. I got a, you know, I talked to a guy. He was a consultant. He moved his family from Chicago to Vermont to work at a luxury glass company. And 3 days later was 9/11. No one was buying luxury glass. And he loses his job. He's just relocated his family. And he's like, I'm a consultant. I'm going to call 22 people. I'm going to make a plan. And he moved to Africa, right? By the way, to start a nonprofit, he adopted a kid, changed his family's life, et cetera. So some people that are the 212 item to-do listers are good at the messy middle, but they're bad at the long goodbye because they don't want to confront the emotions.
Right.
You know, I've looked hundreds of people in the eye and I've said them as I'm looking you in the eye through this computer right now and saying, you know, what's the biggest emotion? I'm going to ask you, back when you were in your in the state that you described of thinking that your life was over, what was the biggest emotion you were struggling with at that time?
I think, well, I don't know if it's emotion, but I'm a guy, so I only have two, right? Anger and happiness. But it was an overwhelming sense of failure and letting everyone down. I mean, just I just felt completely like a failure, like I let everybody in my life down. There wasn't anybody that I was there that I felt like I was serving.
So I would categorize that at the third most popular answer. The number one most popular answer when you ask people that question is fear. How am I going to get through this? I don't, you know, how am I going to pay my bills, right? How am I going to get up every day and deal with my young children? I just lost my spouse, whatever. So number one is fear. Number two is sadness. I'm sad. Like I liked having this job, right? Or I loved living with this loved one. And now that they're no longer living with me because we're divorced. So number two is sadness. Number three, And it's interesting you bring up the gender issue. Number three is shame. And that's what I heard. That's what I heard you say. And what's interesting is I would have thought, and I did, I write in Life is in the Transitions, that I would have thought shame, that men would admit it fewer, and it's equal. There's no gender, breakdown in what people, so the shame is, I'm ashamed of my behavior. I shamed what I did when I drank too much. I'm ashamed I have to ask for help. If I'm at the supermarket and someone asks me, you know, a simple question, how are the kids? If I have a child with an anxiety disorder or an alcohol, you know, abuse disorder, like I'm ashamed, a very simple question. Yeah. And so the point is, these are emotional and you can make a to-do list and you can go right to the messy middle. But if you don't confront the emotion, if you don't accept that this is a difficult thing and do something with that emotion, your transition will not be successful. This is one of the reasons that there takes so long. And for 100 years, and from since the guy, this German anthropologist invented the idea of transitions 100 years ago, Arnold van Gennep, everybody has said that you go through the various stages in order, and you don't. Just like life is nonlinear, you know, a life transition is nonlinear. So the essence of it is understand, I mean, the response to my work in general, and this is a technical scientific term, I apologize for using it, but if people read or hear or watch my TED Talks, when they say, you are describing what I'm feeling.
Right.
And putting words to something, I didn't know there were, like my wife likes to say of me that I have hard knowledge about soft things. The essence of it is you're not alone. I mean, I always say this, the number one three words to say to anybody who's going through a difficult time is you're not alone.
Right.
You're not alone. There's knowledge out there. There's wisdom out there. You can get through it with other people. But you have to think about these things as events that you go through multiple times in your life. And I would venture to say the stories you've been telling me illustrate that. Like the hardest question that I get about life transitions is, can I make them go faster?
Right.
And I think it's hard because I think the answer is no. I think that they're just going to take a certain amount of time to work. But the flip side of that is you can do them better.
Right.
And I would suggest to you, as someone who just does this all day, every day, that the fact that you just went in 10 days with, admittedly, it's probably a disruptor and not a life quake,
dissipatitis,
but the fact that you were able to flip the script to what can I learn and how can I make meaning in my life from this event builds off of the skills of what you went through X number of years ago when you went through the bigger one. That's sort of my message to people. Like if you or someone you know is in a life quake, and absolutely 2/3 of our country right now is in a work quake where they're reimagining what they're doing. If you come on this journey with me, you're going to meet people who were where you are and a lot of them were a hell of a lot worse than you.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going to get tools to help you get through them more effectively.
That's amazing. That's truly amazing. You know, I studied Joseph Campbell's work and, you know, the hero's journey. There's a lot of different phases of that. I'm sure you're familiar with that. But, and I thought about that at the time, but it didn't give me necessarily any tools. It didn't soothe my soul, right? Even though I knew I was at the dark night of the soul, one, I was naive and thought that it was a very short amount of time. And now you're kind of describing in a much longer form. But I was like, should the dark night of the soul last for months and years? I mean, because that's what it was.
So let me address that because I do know quite a bit about Joseph Campbell. So those of you who don't know Joseph Campbell, so Joseph Campbell is an academic who then reads a lot of mythology and teases out in a hero, the hero with a thousand faces, you know, what he calls, you know, sort of the monomyth, like a sort of a general arc. But he's doing this essentially in the second half of the 20th century, when the world was enthralled with the idea of a linear construct. So I was saying earlier, right, in the ancient world, it's cyclical. In the middle, then the linear idea comes along. Up, down is the Middle Ages. But it's not until the birth of science and the rise of science in the 19th century when the idea of linear constructs takes over, right? So you then got Freud with his psychosexual stages. You've got Erikson with the 8 stages of moral development. You've got Piaget with the children's development. You've got the 5 stages of grief. You've got the hero's journey. All of these in about a 2 or 3 decade period in the middle to late 20th century. The problem is those are all linear and they're dangerous. And they're dangerous, here's why. And let's just take the 5 stages of grief. The 5 stages of grief is that there are 5 stages. By the way, first of all, the 5 stages of grief have nothing to do with grief. They were designed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross with people who were dying, not people who were mourning, but people who were coming to turn, and it jumped.
With their own death.
And it was, you know, first, I can't even remember them and repeating them. I don't want to do the damage, but denial, first you do this, and then you deny it. And the reason it's I use the word dangerous is, because you think, well, if I'm doing denial and anger in the wrong place, there must be something wrong with me.
Yeah.
No, there's something wrong with the idea. And the problem with the hero's journey is it says everything has to be in order. First, you got to have the call. Then you got to cross the threshold. And like the problem is that describes almost no one's journey. I made a 6-part TV series for PBS called Sacred Journeys with Bruce Feiler, where I went on 6 pilgrimages around the world. Even pilgrims don't reflect this model. And that's not even to mention women, right? So it's a very male-centered, here we go again, back to the masculinity, right? And the person who invented the idea of a midlife crisis was a guy named Elliot Jacques. And he didn't research anybody. He just read a bunch of biographies of famous men and concluded that they all had a midlife crisis. And when asked why women didn't
have a midlife crisis,
have this, he was like, oh, well, menopause throws the whole thing off.
Okay.
If menopause throws the whole thing off, then the whole thing is off. And you can't tell people that they must fit into one rubric if half of the population is having, you know, a huge involuntary, even expected life quake in the middle of their fifth, sixth decade alive, then your model doesn't work. And it's the same thing with the hero's journey. Like, it doesn't fit the kind of women because their path is different by and large, which is why there's been like the heroine with 1,000 faces and people trying to do the opposite. So what you're saying is that your life is not linear, and therefore something linear like these things, it doesn't work anymore. That's why we have to embrace the idea of nonlinearity, and that there is no schedule that we're not meeting, and there is no path. And as we can turn to work now. It's the same thing in work, a career, a path. These are all like climbing the ladder, right? And these are all linear constructs, and it doesn't relate to how we work. And that's what I've tried to bust through in my latest work.
I'm a big fan of your passion. If nothing else, I'm a huge fan of your passion, but just that your drive to actually study this, interview people, make discoveries, and then impart the knowledge back so that, like you said, it doesn't necessarily change the length of time, but hopefully it allows people, maybe I'll use the word grace, but just allows them some breathing room in the process, because I think that's a big part of it, right? And even as I was going through some of these, going through the process, you know, I knew that I was supposed to be reaching out to people, but when you're in the deal, you don't want to, right? Especially with shame. I'm too ashamed to reach out to people. That's the whole problem, right? And so even in my depression and in my grief, it was like I was ashamed to reach out to others. And I've been through a lot of leadership training, a lot of personal development stuff, meditation, all the things. But without having, I think, to your point, I think I was still trying to match them up with some type of linear process that I was failing at, right? Like, I shouldn't be doing this because I am this old, or I shouldn't be feeling like a failure because I've done all this stuff in business. It's not matching my view of who I am, right? What my experience of life is not matching what I've told myself who I am. That makes sense.
The single most quoted line back to me in recent years is the following. It gets to the heart of what you're talking about here, which is that we have linear expectations and we have nonlinear lives.
Right.
And the problem is that we look at our life and we are dissatisfied, or we think we're doing something wrong. Mm-hmm. I'm unhappy in my relationship. You know, the religious institution that I grew up in is no longer meeting my needs. I've lost a parent and I'm grieving. I have a child who's not living up to my expectation of what my child was going to be. Okay. I'm unhappy in my work. I'm dissatisfied. I studied one thing in college and 10 years later, I want to do something else. So that's an expectation that we had that life was going to be linear. But in fact, as we're living it, we find that it's nonlinear. And the core thing, if I could almost like do one thing in this conversation, it would be to stop putting the blame on yourself or your feelings, and pivot that blame to the expectations. Where did we get the idea that life is going to follow a set path? Well, part of it is the undergraduate textbooks, which tell us that you can only have a life crisis on birthdays that end in zero. Let's just take the pandemic.
Right.
The very simple thing. If you were between 39 and 44 and a half, you know, you were in a midlife crisis. But if you were between 52 and 63 and a quarter, you were also in a crisis. Or if you were like my teenagers were, 14 and a half and 24, you're also in a life crisis. It's the whenever life crisis. It's not the midlife crisis. Okay. And the same thing with work. Okay. You know, for most of human history, there was no idea of a career. So what is the search? The search is, I did another round of interviews focused on work. Mm-hmm. Okay. Trying to figure out what can we learn. And my book is based around what I call the three lies and one truth about work. So lie number one is that you have a career. For most of human history, there was no such word for a career. You didn't need it. 90% of people lived where they worked and worked where they lived, and you did everything. You tended the fields, you made candles, you cared for your sick relatives, you educated your children. Like, there was no word for a career. There was no word for a job. Okay. It wasn't until the Industrial Revolution that the idea of a job and a career, where did this idea of a career come from? People, I was on TV recently and on the business channels, and they said, can you believe, Mr. Filer, can you believe that 3,500 people lost their job last month because of AI? This is a totally destabilizing event. My response was, do you know how many people lost their job in the agricultural revolution? A third of the country.
Right.
And they didn't just lose their job when they were plows and things like that. They moved to cities.
Right.
Where they didn't know anybody because there was a bunch of new jobs. And so a guy named Frank Parsons, the story is in The Search if you care, invents the idea of a career in 1908. And suddenly everyone's convinced they got to have a career, a word that and concept that never existed. Okay. Right. And he said you could only do it once, only if you were a male. And if you changed jobs, there was something wrong with you and you needed to be institutionalized. I mean, that was the idea.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So 50 years later, they invent a new idea. And that is the resume. We think that there was no resumes before 1950 because nobody needed them.
Right. Yeah.
And so what does the resume do? It fetishizes the idea that each job is supposed to be a linear progression. Everyone's supposed to be more responsibilities and more money. That's a ridiculous burden. Think of all, I mean, I'm in my 50s. Think of all the women who were told, if you get off the escalator, you'll never get back on. If you want to spend time with your children, right? Or you want to start a nonprofit and it fails, or you want to go into public service, or you want to join the military. Nothing has squandered more human potential than this idea that if you get off the escalator, you can never get back on. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. Get back on, right? And guess what? It was the pandemic when everybody was in a life quake. Mm-hmm. What happened? There was no longer a stigma against quitting your job. And as a result, 50 million Americans quit a job in the last year. That's a third of the workforce. And another third said, screw it. I don't want to commute 4 hours a day from the suburbs to the city. Like, I'll go to the office, but only 3 days a week. But it's all part of the same process of breaking away from this linear prison that we've been in and mm-hmm. giving ourselves the freedom to live nonlinear lives. And the key to living a nonlinear life is to ask yourself, what is it that gives me meaning today? Mm-hmm. Not 6 months ago, not what my parents want, not what my religious institution wants, not what my culture wants, what I want today. And right now it may be making money, but it also might be giving back. It also might be, you know, service or whatever it is. So the key is, and that's why the search includes what I call a meaning audit, like 21 questions mm-hmm. to find work you love, a series of questions to ask yourself to figure out what is most meaningful to me right now. It brings us back to exactly where we started. The reason I use the word life quake mm-hmm. and the reason I use the word work quake is because they're value neutral. Most of the time that we talk about these events, we say it's a crisis, it's a catastrophe, whatever. And that does not capture people's lived experience, because people's lived experience isn't even the most crisis, chaotic, depressing, awful times in our lives often lead to a sense of growth and renewal and recreation. Mm-hmm. Accommodate the grief or the sadness or the fear or the shame and still manage to find meaning through it. Okay. And even things that are joyful. I mean, I'm the parent, as I mentioned earlier, of identical twin daughters. Trust me, their birth was a life quake. I mean, it was joyful, but every, you know, my work life, my wife's work life, everything to be. So there were different.
Right?
Exactly. There were difficult parts of it too. So by looking at these as neutral events, opens up the possibility that even in the bad, we can find good, and even in the good, there can be difficult parts of it. Because ultimately, and this gets back to what I asked you, where's the agency? The agency lies with us. And I think the stories that you've told me is that what you've learned, and by the way, I don't even know that much about you, but I know that this lifequake that you went into also seems to have led into a workquake, which has led you to do,
oh, totally.
Right? Which is engaging with people, building community, having conversations about raw, real, vulnerable things, because that can work, right? You burst through the shame. You burst through the gendered wall that said men aren't supposed to talk about this and have a conversation like two men of our age are having right now. That's a workquake, but it's all the same thing. It says, in the story of my life, I don't want to run away from what happened to me. I don't want to, I'm ashamed, lock it in the closet, okay? Bury it, sweep it under the rug. I want to have the difficult conversation. When you were in the hospital with your appendix, or maybe this doesn't exactly sync, I was at Thanksgiving dinner where my sister plays this corny game that I always roll my eyes at, but always works, which is, what are you grateful for, right?
Right, yeah, of course, yes.
And she puts me last, even though it's her game. And I said this time I was thankful for three things. I was thankful for technology, which in the group chat with my children who are off in college now, we can keep vaguely in touch. Like that was the beep that we heard a few minutes ago. I was thankful for the calls that didn't come in the last year. We had expected some calls about medical problems or that didn't come. And the last thing, I mean, this is Thanksgiving. You're supposed to be, I love my family, you know, and I love the puppy and I love the cranberry sauce. You know, and I love butterflies and flowers. I ended this where 11 people went around and I said, I'm thankful for difficult conversations because that's what helps us get through, is the willingness to be vulnerable, the willingness to ask for help, the willingness to say, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm lost in the woods. Like, you know what? We want to banish the wolf in the fairy tale. We want to banish the ogre under the bridge. We want to banish the scariness in the woods, but you can't banish the wolf, because if you do, you banish the hero. And if there's one thing I learned, it's that we all need to be the hero of our own story. And that's someone who gets through the woods, past the wolf, over the bridge, and writes her own story and does so in a way that keeps us moving forward.
I love it. There were so many mic drop moments. I'm just going to let that be a mic drop moment right there, Bruce. How do people best follow your work? Because it sounds like it's ever evolving. So you've got the book, these last two books, which are focused on what we've just talked about, which is amazing. You've got the Council of Dads out there about your previous journey. But how do people follow the ever-evolving story? Or is there a way?
There's a way. I mean, I'm Bruce Feiler, which is F-E-I-L-E-R. I'm on pretty much all social channels at Bruce Feiler, whether that's Instagram or Facebook or LinkedIn or everything else. So I'm at Bruce Feiler. I do write a weekly newsletter. I'm going to write one tonight. Maybe I'll allude to this conversation, called The Nonlinear Life, which is at brucefeiler.substack.com. If you go to brucefeiler.com, you can see all of these books are mentioned there and linked. I have three TED Talks. I travel around the country speaking on these themes, and I love nothing more than hearing people and the chance to share this story. And I'm grateful that you invited me, and I hope that we can keep the conversation going.
I love it. I love it. And yes, please, anytime you want to have a conversation, I'd love to have you come on. I think others can connect to it because it is our life. And I think it's just a breath of fresh air that you're breathing into this conversation. And I'm sure every conversation you're having, but a breath of fresh air to know, one, I'm not alone. We're not alone. We're in this thing called life together. It's actually good to reach out. It's good to connect. It's good to be human and allow ourselves to be human, right? I think that's a big part of it, is just allowing ourselves the humanity of the thing. Yes. So I think your message is extremely timely. And if there's anything I can do here at the Bright Vibe podcast to help disseminate your message, I would be honored, and it would help fulfill my want to serve others. So certainly, yes, if you'd like to come back on and talk about any of these subjects again, love to, whether we talk about, you know, masculinity, femininity, different roles, whatever you want to talk about, you're always welcome to come back on, because I've so enjoyed our conversation today.
Thank you for having me. And we can get through this, everybody, if we stick together.
I love it. Thank you so much, Bruce. Thank you for being a part of the Bright Vibe podcast. For more information, go to brightvibe.com. That's B-R-I-T-E, vibe, V-I-B-E.com. Thank you for listening.